Welcome to Evening Under Lamplight on Community Radio in your city, Cambridge 105. Me, I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, inviting you to attend. Catch me at RLA at momentsunderlamplight.com. Tonight, we're talking about, well, our theme is the two different sides of regarding others. One as I, it, the other I, thou. But before we get into our theme, I want to give you a preview of what's coming on Friday, the 13th. That's in just a very few days. Tiffany Stevenson, a friend of mine, who's a stand-up comedian. You will enjoy her. She's putting on her show called The Optimist at The Junction. This is Friday, the 13th, at 8 o'clock. Come to The Junction. And who is Tiffany Stevenson? Here's a wee bit of a blurb. On cloud nine 1 minute and battling your inner critic the next, Tiff Stevenson searches for optimism in a world of Kardashians, guns, and everyday vodka. I'm not sure what that all means, but Tiffany, I know, knows what it's all about, and so will you, perhaps. She was seen most recently on Mock the Week and Drunk Histories. So there you go. Tiffany Stevenson, Friday at The Junction, 8 o'clock. That's the 13th. I'll see you there, because I'll be there too. Next, though, talking about optimists, I thought we ought to have a little optimistic piece here, and this comes from Eddie Lawrence, who plays the role of the old philosopher. You know this piece.
Hiya, folks. You say you lost your job today. You say it's 4 a.m. and your kids ain't come home from school yet. You say your wife went out for a corned beef sandwich last weekend. The corned beef sandwich came back, but she didn't. You say your furniture's out all over the sidewalk because you can't pay the rent, and you got chapped lips and paper cuts, and your feet's all swollen up and blistered from pounding the pavement looking for work. Is that what's troubling you, fella?
Lift your head up high and take a walk in the sun with a dignity and stick to it, and you'll show the world! You'll show the world to get off! Never give up! That ship!
Hey there, friend. You say your radiators didn't work all winter, and now that it's summer, they started up again and you can't turn them off? You say your wife sent your lightweight suits to the cleaners, and that means you'll have to wear your itchy tweeds this morning when they say it'll hit 106? And you gotta meet an important businessman in an hour? And your bridge just broke and you pasted it together with bubble gum and you hope it don't fall apart while you're doing some fast talking to this man? And your shoelace just busted? And you open a big cut on your cheek trying to even out your sideburns? And your daughter's gone out with a convict? And your wife just confessed she gave you last $60 as a deposit on an airplane hangar? Is that what's troubling you, friend?
Lift your head up high and take a walk in the sun with that dignity and stick to it, and you show the world! You show the world to get off! You'll never give up! Never give up! Never give up! That ship!
Hey there, cousin. You say you can't pull your car out of the mud and you're in the middle of nowhere and it's pouring rain and you can't get the top back up and your paycheck's all blurred and your foot went right through the gas and your girl's screaming bloody murder, she's scared of the dark, and a stroke of lightning splits your motor in half and your suit's shrinking up fast and you start up the windy road on foot and 60 yards of barbed wire hits you right smack in a push. And your boat falls down in the mud and a wild animal comes over and runs away with your shoes. And your car blows up suddenly and your windshield wiper ends up in your mouth and you can't move and the mud's rising up to your nostrils and you're sinking fast and you don't hear your girl screaming anymore. Is that what's on your mind, cousin?
Well, lift your head up high and take a walk in the sun with that dignity and stick to it, and you show the world! You show the world to get off! Never give up! That ship!
And now, this is the old philosopher saying, so long, folks.
I think that noise at the end of the track is him actually shooting himself because he can't stand, I don't know what, the horrors that he's been talking about or that phony optimism. Anyways, Tiffany Stevenson gives you real optimism on her show at the Junction on Fridays, so come and hear it and see it. Be there. Okay, booby? Now, back to our theme, or starting our theme. I it. You know about I it? This is a distinction between treating people as it, treating people as thou, a distinction made by Martin Buber in the early or mid 20th century. And we're going to use it to carry us through much of the show tonight. First, we want to talk about people who treat others as an it, a thing to be used or controlled, manipulated. Now, there's nothing wrong with this some of the time. You have some soap, treat it like an it. It's just there to be used, right? Maybe our computer, our clothes, they're just it, things to be used. What about the person who delivers the letters? Or the person behind the till? Or the person blocking the pavement when you're in a hurry? You say, excuse me, but you don't mean it. The words are just a means to get you what you want. That person is an it, an obstacle in your way. Is it okay to treat someone as an it in these circumstances? Well, you have to decide that for yourself. The real problem comes trying to possess somebody. You possess an it. This is the world of the market economy, consumerism, commodities, ads. It's the idea that what you possess will make you happy. You possess soap when you're dirty, that will make you happy. But you're just using it for the job of washing your hands, then you can let it go. You're not possessing it, you're just using it. But when you try to possess something, then you get into real trouble. What about possessing that new smartphone or those cool shoes? Now I can die happy. It's the idea that you're defined by your possessions or by your friends or by your awards or your money. Who dies with the most wins? What a great idea. Now, can we get something just by wanting it? Just by wanting to possess it or achieve it? Is it that simple? Should it be that simple? Well, here's Jimmy Cliff. You can get it if you really want. There's something rather stirring in this motivation. Here he is, Jimmy Cliff.
You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want, but you must try. Try and try, try and try. You'll succeed at last. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Persecution you must bear. Win and lose, you've got to get your share. Got your mind set on a dream. You can get it, don't hold it back. You'll succeed at last. I know it.
Listen.
Rome was not built in a day. Opposition will come your way. But the hotter the battle you see, it's the sweeter the victory. Succeed at last. You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. But you must try, try and
you'll succeed at last.
You can get it if you really want. I suppose you can sometimes. But you know what? Sometimes it happens that you can't always get what you want. And that's a problem. We're going to start with the Rolling Stones here. You can't always get what you want. But you can hear them softly in the background. Who's that singing? Who's that? Listen to them coming up, coming up, coming up. That is the London Bach Choir. And it's amazing to me to think that in that choir in 1969 or 68, November 68, when this was recorded, that was my mother-in-law singing in that choir. My wife, I think, hadn't quite joined it. My sister-in-law was probably in it. Maybe my brother-in-law, I don't know. So the whole family was a Bach choir family. And here they are backing the Rolling Stones. Amazing idea. there goes the choir. We're going to cut off now. Bye-bye, Rolling Stones. So, what do you do when you see her today at the reception? A glass of wine in her hand. Do you want her? You sure? Is she an it that you can desire to possess? You know, it turns out, when she comes back at the end of the song, in her glass was a bleeding man, and she was practiced in the art of deception. And most of the things that you want or crave are deceptive, because you see them only from the perspective of your desires. You're blind to what or who they really are. So, of course, you can't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, you just might find you get what you need. I like that. You try, but you get something else. Someone else was in control who knew better. That's humbling. Now, there's another problem with I-it, and that is that you feel you have to earn your worth. If your life is surrounded by objects, there's no people, you just judge things by the number of objects people have, rather than any inner worth that was there all along. This is the world of rewards and punishment. You judge one thing against another on the basis of how useful or pleasing it is to you. What can you get out of it? And I'm afraid we'll move into a little heavier ground here. This is a problem with religion. There are so many people who see God as an it, God as something to control. Like Job in chapter 1 of the book of Job, Job does everything right. He offers all the sacrifices. He does all the rituals in the right way, hoping that that will make his life a good life. In other words, he's sort of bribing God, or he's using God as an insurance policy to make him live the kind of life that he wants to live. He's got to learn. The whole book is about the way he learns to give up that view and accept God as a thou. But we're not going into that tonight. No, sir, not the book of Job. If you follow the rules, you can earn love and a good life on your own terms. This is also the Santa Claus myth. You will get presents, you will get good things, not because you yourself are beloved or loved or valuable, but because you've done good things and you haven't done naughty things. This is, I think, a bad myth. It treats God and everybody else around you as an I-it. Now, if God is an it, so too are the people you come across. You have to judge them and put them in categories. Not just those who don't belong to your religion. Of course, those people are its. You can treat them any way you want. They're just objects. They're going to hell anyway. So who cares about them? But also the people of your religion. As long as they pass the test and are on your side, then they're all right. They've earned your approval because they've done the right thing. They've joined the right party. They've attended the right church at the right times. Everything has to be categorized, classified. People, activities, the kind of food you eat and when you eat it. Now, I think this is very life-denying. You judge life by the number of objects. There's no relationship with anything. You just look at something, put it into a box, and that's life very safe. And of course, bigger is better. My God is my special friend. He'll guide me to my journey's end. He's in my every thought. Now that sounds nice, doesn't it? Nice and holy. Then the next line is, my God really packs them into Earl's Court. Now, this is something from Spitting Image, and the image, the puppet who's reciting these lines, is a mock-up of Billy Graham, who people seem to respect a lot more when he's become older. But in those days, this is the 80s, Billy Graham bragged about the number of people he could pack into Earl's Court. This was all a game of numbers. Our God is bigger than your God. Our God is just in a different class. Our God is bigger than your God. Our God can whoop your God's ass. You know what I mean?
My God is my special friend. He'll guide me to my journey's end. He's there in my every thought. My God really packs them in a cart. Cars.
Our God is bigger than your God. Our God is just in a different class. Our God's bigger than your God. Our God can whoop your God's ass.
My God runs the entire globe. Insists I wear this silly robe.
My God says not to take the pill.
My God says that it's fine to kill.
Is usually right.
My God says love thy neighbor.
As long as thy neighbor is white.
Our God's a Roman Catholic God. That's why we've got a Polish Pope.
Our God don't do much at all. He's too busy smoking dope.
Our God makes us cut our foreskins. Pork we mustn't cook.
Our God says to be merciful.
But you're dead if you love this book.
And now the Reverend Jim Bucker will lead us in prayer.
Lord, can you hear me, Lord? Are you there, Lord? Give me a sign, Lord, if you're looking down on this poor sinner.
Okay, quick, honey. Here, dear. Get your panties off.
My God says that love is sacred, so you mustn't go on telling naked.
Oh, I'm not sure. Does my God exist?
If he does, I bet he's an atheist.
Oh, look at me.
Our God, bigger than your God.
No, no, he refused to. That's true.
Our God says the cow is holy.
Well, our cow is holy too.
Our God's bigger than your God. Our God is gonna send you to hell. Our God's bigger than your God. Our God says your God's awesome.
Yes, your God smells. That's tough. You're all going to hell. Your God smells. This is a great rhyme. That was Spitting Image. My God is bigger than your God. And you can look at that on YouTube and see the visuals that go with it. And you get glimpses of the puppets of Margaret Thatcher and Archbishop Runcie and all sorts of people that are part of the past. You know, I look around in the studio here. There's no doubt about what time it is. I've just counted 8 clocks, 8 timepieces just in this studio. Not all of them I can see without my glasses, really, but we don't care about the time. Remember what T.S. Eliot said, love is most nearly itself when time and place cease to matter. He says that 2 lines after he talks about the time for evening under lamplight. So it's part of our little motto. I wish I had it right in my mind here. Now, the real problem, we've been talking about all these problems about I, it, and the real problem comes from treating a person as an it. You control them to satisfy your needs only, and actually this is what we call slavery. Now, here's a call out to Malcolm Gait. Malcolm gave a talk at Michael House this week about Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner, and he... One of the things he said, which chimed right in with what we're doing here tonight, was Coleridge's remark that the problem with the slave trade is that it confuses a person with a thing. I was reading somebody else, some sort of teenage literature, really, and they were talking about this woman's ancestors, her black ancestors, who were slaves in the American South, and she says the slaves were treated as second-class citizens. I don't think that's right. They weren't citizens at all. They were objects. Only people can be citizens. You know, and the opposite is true, too. You can treat corporations, which should be it, you treat them as people and give them all sorts of breaks that people get. But that's for another time. I want to move on to Asena, which is a one-woman show. It lasts for an hour. We talked about that last month. And maybe you went and saw the performance at the Round Church. Well, Genevieve Cleghorn is coming back to Cambridge on Thursday, the 12th of March. That's in 2 days' time, at the Friends Meeting House at 7 o'clock. You don't have to break the bank to get in there. It's free. Entrance is free. It's part of International Women's Day. And she'll be performing her her performance of Asina, which is the story about Asina, who was an innocent girl in Albania who was lured to England to be locked up in a bedroom as a sex slave. This is sex trafficking. This is part of this big campaign to see if we can somehow make it less of a presence in our world. And following the performance, Genevieve and Stephen Lovelace, who worked together on this thing from Arcadia Rain, will be available for questions and answers, so you can talk to them about this. And after that, there'll be a break for tea and cake, and you'll be able to sign the amnesty letters demanding justice for women around the world who are victims of human rights abuse. It's a two-part evening. Then at Genevieve's, Sina starts at 7, but at 8:30 there'll be a panel discussion on women's rights today with a whole bunch of experts who will be there. And I'm sure if you have something to say, you can speak up and have your voice heard as well. You can come to the first part or the second part or both parts, but try to come to one or the other. And what I have for you now is, we played this on last month's shows, 4 weeks ago, just a two minutes and 20 second excerpt from Asina to give you a taste of what it's all about. This is a very disturbing 2 minutes, and I warn you in advance, it's not dirty. It's got adult content. Just listen in and hear what happens to Asina. Here's Genevieve Cleghorn.
First views of Britain are through tired eyes staring out of hire car window. Green fields flashing by and long, wide roads full of traffic. We arrive in London, outside of an ugly terrace house. Abu tells me this is where we will be staying and we get out. He knocks at the door and this fat man in a brown overcoat answers. Abu says this is his friend Jerry who will look after me, while he goes and arranges things for our wedding the next day. I walk into the house. Abu does not kiss me goodbye. I remember this later. We stand in a corridor of open doors, the rooms in darkness. The house smells of dirt and dogs. Dogs barking and growling at the sound of us. Claws scratching against the closed door somewhere beyond the passage. Jerry turns around to me. I remember smiling at him, about to mention that I had left my handbag in the car. I say nothing, because he hit me in the stomach and pushed me into one of the rooms, closing the door behind me. There are many hands on me, and I fight and scream, but it does not stop them tearing off my clothes. Does not stop the gang rape. That is other expression I have since learned. They pushed me down onto a mattress on the floor, then they abuse me, one after the other. I still fight. I miss myself. The men laugh at this. It does not stop them assaulting me. The door opens and shuts. Men come in and others go out until my struggling stops. My strength gone. Exhausted, I become a lump of flesh. I feel my blood bleed out from between my legs. The dogs bark. My mind closes. And I pass out to sleep my first night in England.
Thank you.
Well, we have followed that with Brooks Kol Nidre, which it seems to me was about the only way you can follow such intense drama. Now I want to move on to something else. It's called Rape Fantasies, and this takes the idea of I, It in a different direction. Rape Fantasies is a story written by Margaret Atwood that appeared in 1977 in a book called Dancing Girls. Rape Fantasies is about Estelle. It's a dramatic monologue. Estelle is talking to somebody for the whole story. That's all we know. As she talks, we pick up clues to who she is and what her situation is, and we guess all the rest from what she says. We learn she grew up in a small town in Ontario, was Catholic, left the church because they changed the ritual from Latin to English. She moved to Toronto. She works in filing. She files away in some nameless company. You don't meet much of anyone in filing except other people in filing, she says. She's tall. She's unattractive. At least she thinks she is unattractive. She had acne when she was young. We learn all these things. She reads other characters well. She's just wonderful with this. She understands the drama going on between the women in the office. She watches the way they pretend to be something, but she knows more about them. First of all, she reads the files and guesses the employees' ages and plays games with herself. Darlene, for instance, is 41, though you wouldn't know it, and neither does she, but I looked it up in the employees' file. I like to guess a person's age and then look it up to see if I'm right. I let myself have an extra pack of cigarettes if I am, though I'm trying to cut down. I figure it's harmless as long as you don't tell. I mean, not everyone has access to that file. It's more or less confidential. But it's all right if I tell you. I don't expect you'll ever meet her, though you never know. It's a small world. That's the way she talks. She just goes on and on and on and on. She goes out at night alone. She goes to a bar hoping to connect with someone else, someone nice. We realize that the story is being told to some man she is in a bar with. She lets him know that they know her at this bar, so she feels safe. She protects herself. Now, this is where we get back to our point. She protects herself by getting him to see her as a person, not an object. Now, the opening scene is set in the women's lunchroom, and they're playing bridge at lunch, but the game is interrupted because one of the women says, "Hey, do any of you have rape fantasies?" This was a big topic in the mid-70s, as people were encouraged to be free about their sexuality. It was a big topic in the magazines anyway. Estelle knows it's just a stupid game, just a fantasy, and she mocks the others' rather earnest fantasies. Here's Chrissy's fantasy. "I think about being in the bathtub with no clothes on," Estelle says. "So who takes a bath in their clothes?" "Well, with lots of bubbles, what I use is VitaBath. It's more expensive, but it's so relaxing." She sounds like some sort of commercial. She lives in the world of advertising and consumer products, doesn't she? "And my hair pinned up, and the door opens, and this fella's standing there, but she hasn't worked out how he got into her apartment. Well, I can't very well get out of the bathtub. The bathroom's too small, and besides, he's blocking the doorway, so I just lie there, and he starts to very slowly take his own clothes off, and then he gets into the bathtub with me." "Listen," says Estelle, "those aren't rape fantasies. I mean, you aren't getting raped. It's just some guy you haven't met formally who happens to be more attractive than Derek Cummins. He's the assistant manager. He wears elevator shoes, or at any rate, they have these thick soles, and he has this funny way of talking. We call him Derek Duck. And you have a good time. Rape is when they've got a knife or something and you don't want to." Now, what's Estelle's rape fantasy? Here's what she's got several. Here's one she tells them. "I'm walking down this dark street at night and this fella comes up and grabs my arm. Now, it so happens that I have a plastic lemon in my purse. You know how it always says you should carry a plastic lemon in your purse? I don't really do it. I tried it once, but the damn thing leaked all over my checkbook. But in this fantasy, I have one, and I say to him, 'You're intending to rape me, right?' And he nods. Notice she has a conversation with him. She speaks to him, engages him, turning herself from an it to a person. So I open my purse to get the plastic lemon, and I can't find it. My purse is full of all this junk, Kleenex and cigarettes and my change purse, my lipstick and my driver's license, you know, the kind of stuff. So I ask him to hold out his hands like this, and I pile all this junk into them, and down at the bottom there's the plastic lemon, and I can't get the top off. So I hand it to him, and he's very obliging. He twists the top off and hands it back to me, and I squirt him in the eye. I hope you don't think that's too vicious. Come to think of it, it is a bit mean, especially when he was so polite and all. See, she always ends up feeling sorry for the guy. I mean, there has to be something wrong with them, she says. Here's another fantasy. The fellow grabs my arm, but I'm really a kung fu expert, can you believe it? And I just go zap with my fingers into his eyes, and that's it, he falls over, or I flip him against a wall or something. But I could never really stick my fingers into anyone's eyes, could you? It would feel like hot jello, and I don't even like cold jello. Just thinking about it gives me the creeps. I feel a bit guilty about that one. I mean, how would you like walking around knowing someone's been blinded for life because of you? You can see the story focuses on the conflict of fantasy versus reality, that is, I, it, fantasy, versus I, thou, which is reality. Rape is a kind of fantasy. It's not engaging with reality because you're treating a person as a thing to be controlled and used like Asina. But if we can somehow shift from I, it to I, thou, it all changes. She treats him as a thou, a person with feelings, hoping he in turn will treat her as a thou too. And if he treats her as a thou, he's not going to rape her. Estelle does not have rape fantasies. She creates little human dramas instead. Dramas about human loneliness. Much more touching than mere contrived fantasies. Now, I wanted to get some sort of reading of this story. I could find nothing anywhere except a 2.5-minute little snippet from Molly Gardner. I don't know who she is. This is on YouTube. And she does 2.5 minutes from Rape Fantasies. It's not the best sound, but I think you can hear it. Here we go. Let's see what it sounds like.
But if you're being totally honest, you can't count those as rape fantasies. In a real rape fantasy, what you should feel is a sort of anxiety, like when you think about your apartment building catching on fire, and whether you should try for the elevator or the stairs, or just stick your head under a wet towel and you try to remember everything you ever read about what to do, but you can't decide. For example, in my rape fantasy, I'm walking along a dark street at night, and this short, ugly fellow grabs my arm, and not only is he ugly with one of those nothing, puffy sort of faces like those guys you have to talk to in the bank when your account's overdrawn. Oh, of course, I don't mean they're all like that. But he's absolutely covered in pimples. So he gets me pinned against the wall, and he starts to undo himself, and the zipper gets stuck. I mean, one of the most significant moments in a woman's life, it's almost like getting married or having a baby. And he sticks the zipper. So I say, oh, for Christ's sake. And he starts to cry. He says he's never been able to get anything right in his entire life, and this is the last straw. He's going to jump off a bridge. Listen, I say, in my rape fantasies, I always end up feeling sorry for the guy. I mean, there has to be something wrong with him, you know? If it were clean, it would be one thing, but worse luck, it never is. So I say, listen, you really should do something about those pimples. If you got them cleared up, you'd be quite good looking, honest. Then you wouldn't have to go around doing stuff like this. I had them myself once, I say, to comfort him. But the thing about these rape fantasies is the man is always someone I don't know, and the statistics in the magazines say the man is always someone you do know, at least a little bit, like your boss or something. Well, I don't mean my boss. He's over 60, he couldn't rape his way out of a paper bag. But another thing is, there's always a lot of conversation. Like, I spend a lot of time thinking about, like, what I'm gonna say and then what he's gonna say. And I think it would be better if you could just get a conversation going. Like, I don't see how someone could do that to someone that he's just had a conversation with, you know, once he realizes, you know, that you're human and you have a life too. I don't see how we could just go ahead with it. Right? I mean, I guess it still happens, but that's just the part I don't understand.
Jefferson Airplane, How Do You Feel? This context of I, It, I, Thou brings a whole new meaning to this old Jefferson Airplane song. There's a real sense of awe at seeing this girl without objectification or desire. To meet a girl like that brightens up my day. Look into her eyes. How do you feel? Who's he talking to? I think he's talking to his heart. She's coming our way. He's in touch with his heart in a friendly way. His heart is a thou. But he can engage his heart only when he sees her as a thou. Notice he never says he wants her to be his. When you have an I-thou relationship, you see the object or the person as it is. You can treat objects as a thou. Treat them not just for our own use, they're more than a possession. We notice things about the objects, we don't take them for granted. We respect their limitations and boundaries. You don't overload your computer or pour coffee next to the keyboard. You don't drive your car at 60 miles an hour in second gear. You don't wash your new red socks with your white handkerchiefs. Respect means moving beyond your own needs and your own way of seeing and doing things in order to accommodate the other's needs and ways of doing things. You can even do that with plants and trees and for people. We take up that invitation to attend to how the person is. We don't desire to possess the person. And it makes us much freer. We can stand back and enjoy them. The Rolling Stones woman at the reception, a glass of wine in her hand. We don't suddenly fantasize about her, but we see her as she is. I knew she was going to meet her connection, and at her feet was a footloose man. There may be something really appealing about her, but we don't really know much. If we saw her as an it, we would be projecting our needs upon her, but if we see her as a thou, you following me? If we see her as a thou, a fellow human being in her own right, looking elegant, alluring, dangerous, we can enjoy the feeling she gives off without necessarily needing to possess it. That's freedom. This is a great line from Joseph Campbell. In fact, it inspired tonight's show. Joseph Campbell says, "You can address anything as a thou, and you can feel the change in your psychology as you do it." The ego that sees a thou is not the same ego that sees an it. Your whole psychology changes when you address things as an it. Try that. See someone or something as it is for its own sake. There'll be a whole psychological shift as heart and mind unite in perception. But it's dangerous to live an I-thou world. I-it is safe. Everything's categorized. Remember, the I-it religion was all very safe. You know who the goodies and baddies are. You do the right things. You go to heaven, all that sort of thing. I-thou religion is dangerous. It's overwhelming. We have to live in the mystery of thou-ness, of relationship. The Greek myths illustrated this by showing Zeus coming down and raping people. This was not rape fantasies or anything. Zeus's love, God's love, came down as an assault upon us because it's just so overwhelming. No man sees my face and lives. We die to our old self. Now, if we transcend I-thou, we come to another stage, which is I and I. That's a Rastafari idea. Not me, me and me, because me is an object and we're not treating ourselves as objects. You and I are one. I and you're another I. You and I are one. We're united in God. We're united in our common humanity. I and I. Use that phrase all the time, please. It makes the world a beautiful, magic place. It's not easy to sustain this vision. And we can come to it only through the gate of an I-thou relationship. Once we become aware of the possibilities of I and I, we also see how far we are from it most of the time. In our world, where one's nature neither honors, neither honor other people as thou, nor forgives, in our world, we fall short of the I and I. Our world is mostly an I-it world, isn't it? One said to another, "No man sees my face and lives." Did you get that? That's I and I. God tells Moses, "No man sees my face and lives." But if one person says that to another, then that person recognizes the Godhead within. Our true face, my true face, your true face. If you see my true face, if I see yours, I do not live. I die to those old I-it ways. Maybe you could tell we're moving into a Dylan song now, and it's called I and I. And notice how the song goes back and forth between the true I and I spirit of honoring this strange woman in his bed and the old self-centered spirit of treating her as it, someone to use or neglect.
A strange woman has slept in my bed. Look how sweet she sleeps. How free must be her dreams. In another lifetime she must have owned the world or been faithfully wed to some righteous king who wrote songs beside moonlight streams. I and I in creation where one's nature needs. than ever does. Besides, if she wakes up now, she'd just want me to talk. I got nothing to say, especially about whatever was.
I'd love to hear the rest of this song. We're cutting it off, though, because we have very little time and we still have to get in Walt Whitman, or at least a little bit of it. Notice how this reading from Walt Whitman fits in with the I Thou theme. I'll read it. I hope you can get some of it and think about this. And if we have a few minutes, I can talk further about it. I am the poet of the body and I am the poet of the soul. The pleasures of heaven are with me, and the pains of hell are with me. The first I graft and increase upon myself, the latter I translate into a new tongue. He takes it all into himself, I and I. I am the poet of the woman, the same as the man, and I say it is as great to be a woman as to be a man, and I say there is nothing greater than the mother of man. I chant a new chant of dilation or pride. We have had ducking and deprecating about enough. I show that size is only development. That's wonderful. What he's saying there is that it doesn't matter what we achieve. If we measure things and assess them and punish them, we've had enough of that. What he says next is this: have you outstripped the rest? That's competition, right? Have you outstripped the rest? Are you the president? It is a trifle. They will more than arrive there, everyone, and still pass on. It doesn't matter what you do or achieve. If you are a thou, your worth comes from within. And then he turns to nature as a thou. He sort of makes love to nature, first to the night and then to the earth, becomes one with it, an I-thou relationship in erotic terms. I am he that walks with the tender and growing night. I call to the earth and sea half-held by the night. Press close, bare-bosomed night. Press close, magnetic, nourishing night. Night of south winds, night of the large few stars, still nodding night, mad, naked summer night. Smile, O voluptuous, cool-breathed earth, earth of the slumbering and liquid trees, earth of departed sunset, earth of the mountains misty-topped, earth of the vitreous pour of the full moon just tinged with blue, earth of shine and dark mottling the tide of the river. Earth of the limpid gray of clouds, brighter and clearer for my sake. Far-swooping elbowed earth, rich apple-blossomed earth, smile, for your lover comes. Prodigal, you have given me love, therefore I to you give love. O unspeakable, passionate love! Thruster holding me tight, and that I hold tight. We hurt each other as the bridegroom and the bride hurt each other.
Into my life on waves of electrical sound and flashing light she came. Into my life with the twist of a dial, the wave of her hand, the warmth of her smile. And even though I know that you and I could never find the kind of love we wanted together alone, I find myself missing you. Often that something special happens, and you happen to be that something special for me. And walking on grass where we rolled and laughed in the moonlight, I find myself thinking of you.
So good night from me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, and Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105. Get in touch at rla@momentsunderlamplight.com, and I'll see you in a fortnight. Bye-bye.
I see into my mind the smell of her hair, the sound of her voice. We once were there.